I love the buildings and the pavement and the malls. I love the factories, I love the rubber balls. I love the ukuleles and the sound of spinning tape. I love the things that people make. I love the tricycles, I love the synagogues. I love the Lego and I love the Lincoln Logs. I love the fishing lures, I love the plumber's snakes. I love the things that people make. Knives, I love the garden gnomes. I love the way that people decorate their homes. I love the ovens and the casseroles they make. I love the things that people make.
Hello, hello. You are listening to These Things That People Make. My name is Sarah Mangle. Today's interview features Sheila Sampath, who is my new awesome friend, and also the editorial director and art director of Shameless Magazine, which is a young person's magazine that is celebrating its 7th birthday tonight at the Toronto Free Gallery. In this interview, Sheila starts by talking about what feminism means to Shameless Magazine.
So to us, feminism is an intersectional approach to feminism. So we talk about, we're an explicitly political magazine now. We talk about gender, we talk about sexuality, we talk about trans issues, we talk about ableism, we talk about racism and classism and Indigenous solidarity a lot. And like, you can't really have feminism without those things. So it's been really exciting to kind of watch it turn from this thing that was defined as alternative, and which is a definition that is, it's like a negative definition in a way, to something that's such a positive description.
Can you describe aesthetically what it looks like, or like what someone would expect if they picked up?
So it's a 48 page magazine with like a glossy cover. You can find it in independent bookstores and then Chapters Indigo. We always feature sort of young Canadian illustrators, mostly young women, I've been art directing it for 5 years, so I love how it looks. we went through a redesign last year when we came out with our new mandate, which was the explicitly political mandate. And so it's been really nice to sort of have a new look, which is, you know, no more distressed type, which was great, but not anymore.
What does it look like to put together Shameless? Like, who is involved and how does it?
Yeah, it looks like a mess. Shameless is completely volunteer run, and if people want to change that, they can go to the website, and we just started a new Hall of Shameless Sustainers program, so for like $5 a month, you can help us keep it alive. But for the last, since it's since its conception, it's been completely volunteer power. And so most of us work full-time or go to school full-time, and then we work on Shameless in our off hours. And I think when we talk about Shameless or we write about Shameless, we'll like sometimes sort of refer to Shameless headquarters. But the reality is that Shameless headquarters is, like, at this very second, Shameless headquarters is right here. It's wherever you are in that moment, because it's, we bring it home with us. We work on it between our other stuff at work. We wake up early in the morning and work on it in our beds. Like, you know, it's sort of one of those things where it's very, the aesthetic of it isn't actually a very DIY aesthetic. Like, it's, I like to think it's actually a really polished magazine, and it competes with the other stuff on the shelf. But the spirit with which it's put together is a really, it's, you know, we operate with really feminist principles. We respect each other. We listen to each other. We have an amazing staff that has this really interesting and unique combination of, like, mad editorial skills with, like, mad activist analysis. And so it's a really, really, really great team right now. And I don't know how we pull it together, to be honest, because it's so much work, but it just happens. And I think it really speaks to the people who work on it.
How many people are, like, the core, and how many?
Well, we work with different writers for every issue. So we have a couple of columnists, but the actual Shameless staff on the masthead, there's 5 associate editors, managing editor, I'm editorial director and art director. We have a publisher and an advertising person. I think we're like in a web team, and we're about probably like 12 to 15 people. But it's very rare to find us all in the same place at the same time.
And are you, like, email making decisions? Or
we meet at least once or twice an issue, once to plan stuff, plan out the issues and have sort of make broad editorial decisions. And then most of the work is done over email. And recently it came out that we all want to be friends with each other, so I have a feeling that we're going to start socializing a bit more. Yeah, it's really nice. It's like, it's a very healthy feminist organization, and I've worked for feminist organizations before, and it can be quite, you know, they're all in different places, but this one right now at this moment is so functional and so getting things done that it's just, the staff is just amazing.
Can you talk about a few of your favorite articles or a few of your favorite pieces that have come out?
Sure. Well, we are actually putting together, like, we're having a launch party tonight at the Toronto Free Gallery, and it's our 7th birthday party. And this issue is, I think I say this with every issue, but I really mean it this time, that it's my favorite. One of the things that really pulled it together was a large, like, I think a six-page feature on language, where we talk about the use of language in activist culture. And it was a really special piece because actually a lot of our editors actually wrote sections of it, and we had some writers come in and write sections of it. And, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, what does it mean when you call someone a name, and what do you do when you mess up, and how do you define yourself with language, and how does the language that you use speak just as much as what you're trying to say. And so it's probably one of my favorite features we've ever done. We also profiled Justice for Girls, who do a lot of activism in the prison industrial complex. And
they're based in BC, right?
Yeah. And they're absolutely amazing. And we also did a profile on Stud magazine. So we have some really awesome articles in this current issue. And I think every issue we do is always my favorite, because we're always pushing ourselves to be better at what we do.
This is a cheesy question, and I don't normally ask cheesy questions, but, like, because you're writing for an audience that's, like, slightly younger than you are, do you imagine that you're, like, that people are writing to your younger self, or, like, how do you...
I never really thought of it that way. I don't think it's a cheesy way of thinking about it, though.
Yeah.
I think, for me, a lot of what drives it is... I'm an activist. I identify as an activist, and I work full-time doing activist work. But I also... I think when I work on Shameless, or we make editorial decisions, or I personally think about what I see for the magazine, I think about, for me, my own sort of turning point, and that point where I became this sort of, like, middle-class kid from the suburbs, like, into an activist. And I think everyone has those moments, and to me, Shameless is about providing access and entry points into that kind of thought. And now that I'm sort of, I identify as an activist, I wouldn't want to be any other way. And it's my lifestyle. It's how I do everything that I do. And I think that if we can provide those entry points to young people, and we can actually talk about things that matter, that we'll have a generation that's as exciting as my generation, or as exciting as generations before. And I think, I just think it's important to make that information accessible and make it digestible, and to make that culture as open as it should be.
This is These Things That People Make. Welcome back. The music you just heard was Rat Tail with a song called Polka Dots. Now we will go back to our interview with Sheila Sampath talking about Shameless magazine.
Like, there's nothing more difficult than acknowledging privilege. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like, and that's a really difficult concept to get people to swallow. And so if you can kind of get someone to start thinking like, hey, like, let me think about my heterosexual privilege, or let me think about my white privilege, that's a really awesome thing to be able to do. But you can't do that through like aggression, and you can't do that through anger. You have to do it through like sort of an openness and accessibility.
Thank you.
Yeah. So
yeah, and like somehow breaking it down.
Down.
Somehow using words that.
Yeah, it's about how you use language, like our new issue.
Yeah, and so is the whole feature of the new issue about language?
One of the new things. So I took over as editorial director last year, and this is the third issue that I've done. And so one thing that I've been trying to do is have more themed issues. So the one that we're working on, the one that we're launching right now, our current issue, is a language issue. And it's not that every article relates directly with language, but there are a few pieces that really pull it together. And our next issue is going to be our politics issue, which I'm very, very excited about. We talk about women in politics, we talk about the institution, like the political institution as an illegitimate institution, and how we can work within that as people who can or cannot vote.
Oh, wow.
Like different ways
Good.
Of kind of like engaging with that, and so whether you know, voting, you can't vote because of status, or you can't vote because of your age, because our audience is younger. What are ways in which you can get involved and take ownership over, you know, something that we engage with every day, because we engage with politics every day. So I'm excited about that. It's a monster. It's a monster issue to tackle, especially in the wake of what just happened electorally.
It's a really interesting political time to talk about that.
Yeah, but it's an exciting time too, and dark times call for like exciting things too,
yeah,
right?
Totally.
It's like good opportunities for your engagement.
I wanted to talk a bit about Sassy magazine. Just because when I started thinking about Shameless, I also started thinking about Sassy magazine and the ways that it changed.
Yeah.
And I don't know, they're very different things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting because I think I read a little bit of Sassy when I was a kid, but I didn't read a lot of it. And to be honest, Sassy Jazzy was great in comparison to what was out there, but at the same time, it didn't really speak to me.
Yeah.
Right? And at a very basic level, it didn't make me feel like, oh, finally, there's this voice that's talking to me, right? Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of young women felt that, but I didn't. But that being said, it was still, like, my favorite. You know, it's Sassy. It was great.
Yeah.
Great. Great in scare quotes. But, yeah, Shameless has been compared a lot to Sassy.
Oh, it has. Okay.
I mean, in the past, I think we had a quote from someone that was like, not since the golden days of Sassy have we seen a magazine like this. And I can't remember who said it, but it was someone, and we were quoted in something that we put together. But it's kind of interesting to think about Sassy, because I think just because our expectations are so low of teen magazines, that it was seen as this really, like, political, like, awesome, empowering thing. And then when you look at it, in retrospect, you're kind of like, wow, this is just as, like, white and heteronormative as, like, every other magazine. It's just, like, not telling you to wear as much makeup, right?
Yeah. I mean, this happens to me often in interviews where, like, I get to a certain point where then I have seven things I'm thinking at the same time. But one of the things I'm thinking about is just, like, as people, like, I don't know how old you are, but, like, in
I'm
their...
29. Mid-
okay.
Full
oh,
disclosure.
Yeah, we have this, we're the same age.
Yeah.
I was like, I feel like we're the same age, but I can't. I think it's a really awesome practice to then have to explain things to folks who are perhaps in a generation that's different than us, and explain our own politics in a way that, you know?
I feel like it's important in general, like, not just an intergenerational thing, but kind of working so much in sort of activist communities with the left, and even like politically, like broader, like mainstream politically with the left. Like, I worked for the NDP for a long time and things like that. And it's kind of interesting to sort of step back and realize that, like, our social movements are really used to talking to each other. Like, as a feminist, I'm used to talking to other feminists. As, like, a young woman, or I'm not, young is debatable, but as a woman of color, I'm used to talking to other women of color about, like, you know, race. And, like I can talk to it, you can talk to an anti-racist about anti-racism all the time. But, like, we don't really know how to talk to people who've never thought about it before.
Yeah.
And I find that the practice of doing Shameless in general has made me a much better activist in general, right? Like, it's been awesome, because now I'm like, okay, well, you know, I don't feel like our movements move forward by just kind of this echoey chamber of us talking to each other. Like, we move forward by communicating to people who have access and have power, and convincing them to relinquish some of that power is a really difficult thing, but you're never going to do that without, like, honest, open, patient dialogue, right? And the burden is on us, because that's the way power works, right? So if we don't learn how to, like, talk to young people, or we don't learn how to talk to people in power, we only know how to talk to each other, and the message doesn't go anywhere. So, yeah.
I think it totally makes sense, the resistance to use the word feminism, because of the broad definitions of feminism at this point.
Like,
it's interesting. I also use the word feminist more and more, in fact.
Yeah. Well,
but
Sarah Palin identifies as a feminist.
Yeah.
So it's like, what does that even mean? Like, you know, it's so different. And, you know, I understand why people don't want to use it. Yeah, it's just, it's one of those things. But it's very interesting to kind of see. I feel like I don't want to use, if I don't want to use the word feminism now, it's just like, oh, I've been through the racist parts of feminism.
Yeah.
I've been through the ableist, horrible, heterosexist parts of feminism. And then, like, now I'm like, I'm tired of you, right? But it's really, what's interesting and kind of, not scary, but it's like, it's very telling that you have young people, like, 15-year-olds, that are like, I would never identify as a feminist. Like, that's what's interesting to me.
I mean, and there is, like, there's a few things that I could guess about that, right? Like, there's the waves of, like, messed upness about feminism, like, extreme histories of, like, racism within feminism that are still going on, right? And then there's misogyny.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So there's, like, these two things that are happening at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very, very interesting. So, yeah, coming up with a tagline ended up being very difficult. So we can use feminism. We wanted to be trans-inclusive, and we wanted to, I don't know, there were so many things that we needed to do. We ended up going with, I'm not going to say what we ended up going with, because it's on our new cover, and then you should go buy the magazine to see what it says. But we do have a new tagline, it's very exciting. Yeah. It's Sassy, without being Sassy, magazine Sassy.
That's awesome. I guess I want to hear about like the challenges of running a magazine that's volunteer run or within this current climate or.
Yeah, I mean, it's. Oh, the challenges. There are so many. We have no money.
Yeah.
And we have to work to, you know, buy cat food and human food, right? Like, you know, and so all of this work is done in our own time, and our own time is limited, right?
And do you have a budget for printing the magazine or for distribution?
It's completely, completely subscriber-based.
Okay.
And QB. QB buys our back ad. Thank you, QB. And, but, yeah, I mean, it's all of the revenue comes from, like, sales of the magazine and, like, a few ads that you see in it. But we probably, you know, maybe we sell, like, 3 or 4 ads an issue. So it's really not a lot in the grand scheme of things. And so that's what sustains the printing of the magazine. So it's not, like, personal money. It's nothing like that. But the labor is completely volunteer.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's probably,
the main challenge.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I think that if I could, for example, like, get paid to work a day on Shameless and take a day off my day job, it would make my life a lot easier. But we don't have that kind of capital. And I think most people kind of feel that way too.
And
but
I
at
think
the same
that,
time, it's worth it, right?
But I think it's also really, like, it's not something people know. Because I think, like, because it's a magazine and not a zine, like, people assume. And there's a lot, like, there's a few magazines like that in Canada right now. Right?
Yeah.
Like, and Good Girl, that's not around anymore, was another feminist magazine in Canada that, like, got no funding.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think it just speaks a lot to what people can do with very limited resources, right? And, like, when you actually sort of step back from it, I mean, I guess it's exhausting, right? But it is worth it, but it's very, very exhausting. And when you kind of step back from that, every time I see it in a store, which isn't that often, working on a magazine all the time, you don't really have time to go to stores.
Yeah.
But the other day, I like walked by one and I saw it on a magazine rack, and like I got so excited that I took a photo of it, and I was just like, that feeling never gets old. And I think it's not even pride, and it's not like, oh, that's mine. Like, it's not ownership even. It's just like, I can't believe what, if you put a group of, you know, like 15 really awesome women and one really awesome dude, if you put them, like, all together and you give them nothing, look what they can make.
Yeah.
Like, that's, like, it's a really awesome thing. And it's kind of, like, I used to make zines when I was younger, and I used to be in that culture. And it's, like, and I remember having that feeling, like, when I went to Canzine or, you know, saw my stuff in, like, at a zine distributor. I'm, like, I made that. And then to kind of look at this, it's just, I mean, a lot of people can do it. And that's what's so exciting about it. Like, that's what's a good feeling. It's just like, you give us nothing, and look how much we do. Imagine if you gave us something, what we could do with it. I can't even imagine. Our expectations are very low.
Is there a lack of, like, funding, like, public, like, grant funding for magazines? Like, there is, like, for, like, bookstores?
I don't know too much about it, but I know that we've tried to apply for grants before. A part of the problem is that for certain grants, we actually don't make enough money in the first place to apply for the grant. So there's certain grants, I can't remember which ones specifically, but we were looking into one that we thought we might have been a good fit for, but the first criteria is you need to have a revenue of, like, $75,000 a year, and you need to be able to pay you need to already pay your contributors, which we can't even pay our staff, so we don't pay our contributors, we have no money, so we were just like, we can't apply for that, we don't have that kind of money, we don't have enough money to apply for funding. So there's that.
That's funny.
Yeah, the other thing is that we're not explicitly an arts magazine.
Yeah.
So there are arts grants for, you know, if we were like, you know, now featuring Awkward
Probably
Camlet.
More like apolitical. Yeah.
Yeah, and so when it's, we fill up our 48 pages with like criticisms, you know, and like politics. And so, I mean, I love arts magazines, but that's what they do. And that's not really what we're doing.
Yeah.
So there isn't really funding for what we do specifically. And if there is, we're looking for it.
Yeah.
If anyone knows of anything, they should let us know. It'd be really nice to get paid.
And so the easiest way to subscribe is on the internet, right?
Yeah.
And it's
www.shamelessmag.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
And if for people who are in Toronto, the launch is tonight at
the Toronto Free Gallery. It's free. It's a birthday party. There's going to be vegan cake. There's going to be awesome performers, including Lol. I don't know if you know them. They're amazing,
awesome.
Amazing, amazing band. We're going to have a stand-up comedian named Mae Martin, and Mae performed at the very first Shameless launch party.
Woo!
Yeah.
That's awesome.
She's an awesome stand-up comedian. So we're going to have we're gonna have a, it's gonna be a birthday party.
I think she's been a stand-up comedian since she was 13, as we mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah. That's young so people can do awesome things.
Oh yeah.
And so can 29-year-olds, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That does it for These Things That People Make today. Thanks so much for listening. Check out Shameless Magazine at shamelessmag.com. And if you're in Toronto tonight, come to Shameless's 7th birthday party at the Toronto Free Gallery, which is 1277 Bloor Street West. That's 1277 Bloor Street West. And check out These Things That People Make's blog at thesethingsthatpeoplemake.blogspot.com. That's thesethingsthatpeoplemake.blogspot.com.